Good morning from New York. Today is Monday, October 5th, and I welcome you to this NIAC Talks podcast in collaboration with the American Bar Association's section of dispute resolution. The title today is Be Inclusive: Opportunities to Take Action for Gender Diversity. We have today an esteemed group of panelists that I will name in alpha order with brief introduction. Sarah Grimmer, she is Secretary General of the Hong Kong International Arbitration Center, or HKIAC. Noyana Marigo is a partner in the New York office of Freshfields Bruckhaus Deringer. Mireille Philippe, Special Counsel at the International Chamber of Commerce, ICC, Court of Arbitration. Dr. Patricia Shagnessy, professor at Stockholm University, and she also oversees the Master of International Commercial Arbitration Law, ICAL program, as well as having served as vice chair of the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce. And last but not least, Santiago Soria is a partner at Marval, O'Farrell, and Mairal. My name is Rekha Rangachari. I am the executive director of NIAC, and I am your moderator today. Two administrative items, please. Posit your questions in the Q&A portal within Zoom. Next, the session is being recorded, so any of your colleagues who can't join us today, not to worry and stay tuned. This podcast will post both to the ABA section of dispute resolutions site as well as to the NIAC audio library. And with that, we are off. We're going to first begin by talking about the ICA report. What is it? Why now? How is it different? And tips and checklists that are relevant and that we want to highlight. And so let's begin. What is it? For this question, I turn both to Mireille and then to Sarah to respond on that. Mireille, Sarah, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rekha. I think that this report is an extremely important tool for many reasons. There has been many publications in the last two decades about the diversity of women in dispute resolution, gender diversity, about the glass ceiling, unconscious bias, women in the workplace, the pipeline leak, and so on. Then, during this last decade, reports and gender statistics started to shed light on the real situation in the business and the legal communities around the world, such as the McKinsey reports. In addition to these reports, some of us have collected and published statistics like Louise Barrington, Noemi Galor, Lucy Greenwood, and myself. And since the pledge on the equal representation in arbitration, the major dispute resolution organizations started publishing statistics on a regular basis on the number of female arbitrators and mediators nominated. This is extremely important to help measure progress, to assess whether efforts are producing the results expected, and what concrete actions may be taken to improve gender diversity. So there existed a wealth of material, but such material was not organized in one place and in a way allowing people to find information easily and learn about these various subjects. This is what the ICA report on gender diversity achieves. It gathers the swells of data on everything you need to learn about gender diversity in dispute resolution. So it's a comprehensive and thorough report that explains where the problems first of lack of diversity lie. It provides hard data to evaluate the progress. And the statistics, were provided by leading international arbitration institutions. So this is an important data. It informs about initiatives undertaken by various organizations, firms, and groups promoting female practitioners in dispute resolution. It provides an analysis of the barriers impeding or slowing down gender diversity, such as the pipelines leak or the unconscious bias. And most importantly, it provides tips and recommendations of potential opportunities to promote gender diversity and tools to overcome biases. So the report provides a clear picture of the current situation and how we can contribute to reach a better representation of women in dispute resolution. It can be used as a toolkit of tools available to us to overcome obstacles and contribute to change. It is a roadmap for those who are committed to improve gender diversity, and I consider that it is an indispensable tool that any individual, organization, firm should have handy. It provides guidance in how to continue the positive trend.
Thanks so much, Mirez. Sarah, if you'd also weigh in on this.
Thanks a lot. I think Mirez has given an excellent introduction to the report. I first learned about the idea of the report, I think it was back in 2017 when it was at its genesis. And now we are 3 years on and we see the report come to full fruition. And as Mirez describes it, I think it's really going to be a reference point for discussion, especially in international arbitration with respect to gender diversity and ways to move forward and ways to identify and start to break down some of the barriers to equal representation for women in international arbitration. It provides an excellent set of data that has been provided by 8 of the major international arbitral institutions, and essentially it provides a snapshot of the situation between 2015 and 2019. We have 5 EU-based arbitral institutions, 2 US-based and 1 Asia-based, and we also have the statistics that have been furnished by the Court of Sports Arbitration and by the Permanent Court of Arbitration. The task force is a group of 23 members that comprises the international arbitral institutions as well as some of the major international arbitration organizations and law firms and chambers. So you really have a lot of information coming in from different sources. The report itself is 115 pages. It covers a lot. It's divided into 3 parts that Mirez has described, and it has 9 appendices, 7 of which contain a lot of data around arbitral appointments, and then 2 of which distill some of the best practices and initiatives of some of the arbitral institutions. And the last appendix provides a checklist for recording data for institutions and also identifying opportunities to address diversity. So a really important checklist. For those of you who are really interested in reading the report, but it's hard to find time to set aside to read 115 pages in one go, but if you need a checklist to go to, you can go to the last appendix, and that's all there. So really a reference point for everyone interested in this topic and providing a very valuable snapshot of data between 2015 and 2019.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Thanks, Mirez. I wanted to highlight as well, what the report does so succinctly is to capture the diversity of stakeholders that participate in the international arbitration space. And we've tried similarly to capture that here on this panel. Patricia, if we can turn to you, can you give us the temporal relevance? Why this snapshot now?
Well, I think the time was right for it. Now, the pledge had been around for a few years, and it had really been making significant difference in the number of appointments of arbitrators, particularly by institutions. And I think it was time to take a temperature, see where we are at, what has been working, how is the needle moving, so to speak. And armed with that information, and as Sarah pointed out, it was a lot of detailed data that was gained through the institutes, through the other members. And armed with that, we can start to take a look at where can we go from here? How can we look at actual initiatives and measures that are already doing positive work, but we can ramp them up, we can replicate them, and we can innovate new initiatives. So I think it is time to move beyond just the appointment of arbitrators and to start to see diversity becoming really, truly inclusive throughout our entire community of users. So I think the timing was right.
Well, towards that word you used, innovation, we're hearing that a lot these days. And so the question I pose to you, and I'm also going to ask Mirez to weigh in, how is it different? How is it innovative from other reports of similar ilk?
Well, I think it's, as Mirez and Sarah pointed out, that it has a number of different components. So one thing that it got is it brought together data during this 2015 to 19 period where there's been some movement, so it was a good time to gather that. And it does an analysis of that data, so you get all that data in one place instead of having to go and try to gather things which are not as deeply detailed from different websites. It also conducted interviews with different members of the arbitration community to share their experience and how they face challenges and manage to get past those challenges. I think that particularly younger entrants into the arbitration community will feel encouraged and feel inspired and find in the toolkit and in the checklist ways in which they can move their careers forward. And I'm hoping that law firms such as that those Freshfields and Santiago's law firms, different parts of the world, as well as clients, the users, will also be inspired by this report to move forward. So it really has a broad approach.
Thank you. Mirez, back to you. Any other distinctions between this report and others?
Well, as Patricia mentioned, Sarah, also myself, I think this is really a report which is so useful and handy, mainly the checklist at the end of the report is really something that I recommend any person should read regarding how to promote yourself, what are the actions that you can undertake to overcome obstacles and fight gender diversity discrimination. I think it is really useful, and it was time, as Patricia mentioned, to have such a tool available to everyone around the world. It's true that it is more specifically adapted to the dispute resolution community, but I think that it can also inspire other communities. It is not only, the recommendations that we speak about are not only useful for the dispute resolution community. So I think this is really an excellent report, which will be updated with the time, but it's a report that anyone can make use of.
Great. So we're going to hone in on something Sarah and Mirez have highlighted already, this notion of tips and checklists. And so, Noyana, can you give our listeners what's top of mind to go through there with the tips and the checklists and any other items?
Sure, thank you. Actually, this is part four of the report, which sets out opportunities and concrete ways to address gender diversity problems. And for me, it's one of the most useful part of this report, because as important as understanding where we are, the causes of the problem and the problem itself, is even more important to know how to fix it and also to see what things have been working already in some regions or in some aspects and try to replicate those elsewhere. So of course there are many, many examples. I won't have the time to discuss all of them, but I have chosen some that are very close to my heart, at least I think that are very important because they can really make a difference. One is in terms of the resources we have when we have to appoint an arbitrator. And what we have in the checklist is a list of the different resources and databases where we can find qualified female candidates. And just to name a few, we have, of course, the Arbitral Women database and also the Pledge Search Committee. And why do I think this is so important? Is because if we think about how we generally decide who are going to be the candidates for either an arbitrator list or directly to appoint them, normally we brainstorm. We brainstorm with colleagues. And by doing that, what you do is just you reinforce the likelihood that you're going to put on your list people who you already know and who have already served as arbitrators. And that's how you end up always appointing more male than female. So taking the time and the effort to go to the databases and look at the people who are qualified and can serve on your specific case is key. The second one is directories. We all know that people sometimes go to the Chambers list, for example, or Legal 500 to see who is ranked. And on the basis of that, might take decisions as to what counsel to hire or what arbitrator to appoint. Again, if we look at the process on how people are ranked, basically is getting the researchers get feedback from peers. And the way it is structured, you're going to be asked feedback on the people that are already on the list. And if you look at the list today and has improved a little bit in the last couple of years, but of course, is mostly dominated by male arbitrators or male counsel. So it is important for a lot of us to understand that when we participate in those research, first of all, we have to provide the information that required, but at the end, they will ask you whether you have any comments on the list. And that's the perfect moment to note that there is a lack of diversity, and also have ready your list. Look at the people who you think should be ranked, and be ready also to explain how those female candidates compare to those male candidates that are already ranked. And I think that will help to improve those lists in the future. When you look at the list today, we have a lot of up and coming female counsel, which is great, and a very few ranked as top three, four, five. So we really need to work and improve those lists. One more topic, and now if we look at what counsel or litigation founders can do, I think clients have a big say in terms of helping female to get more exposure by either promoting or maybe taking business away from firms who either don't allow women to be first chair or do cross-examination, because all these affect their visibility and in turn affect their ability to be appointed as arbitrators later. And again, there's a long list and very useful list, so I encourage everyone to go and look, and it's an easy read. And the report is long, but that part is really very easy to read.
Thanks so much, Nuyana. There you have it, also a gentle call to action, right? It is all of our duty to help push this needle forward. Sarah, if you would also weigh in any further comments as we look to these checklists and tips.
Yeah, I would say these checklists are really encouraging, because they are the result of a lot of intellectual energy, a lot of people who have brainstormed and been thinking about these problems, this problem, and also what can we do about it. And so how the report presents this aspect is that it looks at what we can do. So it's the part that Nuyana has referred to is written in this way: what can I do? And then from five different perspectives, we have a multiplicity of answers to these questions. And those five perspectives are, first of all, I nominate or appoint arbitrators. So that's a really important aspect of this report. What can institutions do? What can counsel do? What can co-arbitrators do, for example? Number two, I am an in-house counsel or a litigation funder. What can I do? Number three, and also a very important one, I am a qualified female candidate. What can I do? Fourth, I want to develop experience and expertise. So for the younger, less experienced people, what can I do? And then finally, I employ future female arbitrators. What can I do? And so that really means that, you know, you can take a look at these checklists and the control comes back to an individual level, an organizational level, a company level, and makes us all agents of change. And I think that that's really encouraging.
Thank you. So of note as well, Patricia, Mirez, Sarah, and Nuyana were all contributors to this report, but it's always important to take a step back and to get weigh-in from the broader community. Santiago, we turn next to you. Can you share your views on this report, on the state of diversity in general? Any other comments? The floor is yours.
Sure, Rekha. I really share what Mireille, Sara, Patricia, Nuyana have described. I was very impressed by this report when I read it, because I think that it deals with the current situation on gender diversity with a lot of hard data, which is also a good tool for everybody to understand. I think it's an outstanding paper that has became a must for people who would like to be involved in these matters. If I have to highlight three issues or points that this paper attract me more, I would say the first question, why it matters? Why it matters is still a question that we have to deal with, because it's important to continue strengthening the inclusion of women in arbitration. Awareness, because it's not for granted that gender diversity in arbitration is absolutely a priority for everyone. In law firms or in companies, we still find that this is something that we should still work on. And that is why I really appreciate the deep description of the current situation of this matter. This is one of the things I really appreciate, and it's a very well done paper. The second one I would say is the data. The data helps to understand the matter, because when you see the figures, it's really have an impact on the reader, because it's not just a discussion or description of how the matter is dealing with by associations, law firms, institutions. The hard figures show how this matter is really an issue to take over by everybody. And last, I would say defective actions, because I think that in this kind of papers that we have read, sometimes what is missing is this effective action, and many of you have described what should be done in order to improve this, which are the tools for the women to improve this. If I want to appoint someone, what are those directories that Noyana mentioned, the toolkit that Patricia also mentioned, to be appointed as well. So I would say that the comprehensive analysis of this report for me is really an outstanding paper that I highly recommend.
Thank you so much, Santiago. You know, without being presumptuous about what else exists in the space, we're now going to pivot to what's happening in the realm of other diversity initiatives. But the focus is on the new things, in addition to directing you to each of the websites that exist for these initiatives so you can read more there, appreciating our time is short. Mirez, we go to you first. Arbitral Women, please tell us what's happening on the ground.
Thank you. I think at first it's important to understand that the objective of Arbitral Women is to design a space where female dispute resolution practitioners can gather, communicate with each other, trade ideas, and promote each other. So how do we achieve this? Our first marketing tool is the website that gives access to a directory of members, as was mentioned earlier, with access to their profile. And a Find Practitioner multi-search tool offers the possibility to find female practitioners in any given field. We also offer visibility to our members through news about members and through our newsletters, which report about events at which members spoke on panels. In our newsletters, interviews with role models and reports about women initiatives in their workplace, because we consider both subjects to be inspirational for other women practitioners and for young generations. We have a mentorship program for members with less experience, but also for members who need assistance from their peers. So we support teams also competing in moot courts, provided they include 50% of female students. Now, what are our signature programs that we continue offering? First, the Arbitral Women Diversity Toolkit meant to share our experience in this field by offering trainings on learning to recognize unconscious biases, so our own biases, and tools to overcome them. And some of the tips that we use in our trainings exist in the ICA report. Another signature program is the SpeedNet events, inspired by speed dating to allow female dispute resolution practitioners from all profiles and generations to meet. And this has been replaced during the pandemic by a one-on-one program called Connect to meet virtually other members or even female practitioners, non-members yet of Arbitral Women. We have a parental mentorship program that seeks, for instance, to match members who are new mothers with others who have a recent experience of learning how to balance the demands of parenthood with a career, while being a separate program for the regular professional mentoring scheme. It is complementary, though. We also relaunched an important program, a cooperation program intended to partner with like-minded organizations and groups to mutually promote our works and events and to cooperate on given projects. But I would like also to say that in general, we welcome new projects, but we need to be realistic. It is better to ensure continuity and to reinforce existing programs until they become easy to manage before launching new projects. It is fine to be ambitious and bring many ideas to the organization, but it is equally important and even more important, and this is also true in our profession, in our career, it is important to deliver what we have committed to with ongoing projects. You generate trust by showing continuity, by proving that you are reliable and capable of delivering. I will stop here because I think I can speak a lot about Arbitral Women, but this, I think that we need to hear about the others.
Mirez is one of the founders of Arbitral Women, and so thank you so much. We move next to the ERA pledge. Noyana, please.
Yeah, thank you. And just for those who are not that familiar yet with the pledge, the Equal Representation in Arbitration pledge was drawn up in 2015. And the idea was to stop talking about the gender diversity problem and take concrete steps to solve that problem. So basically what we did was have two objectives in mind: improving the profile and representation of women in international arbitration, and also promoting the appointment of women as arbitrators on an equal opportunity basis. And that message is very important for us, on an equal opportunity basis. And we decided that we would ask signatories to commit to ensure that whenever possible, the list of potential arbitrators or tribunal chairs that they would have to provide or to consider would include a fair representation of female candidates. And for those who had the power to appoint an arbitrator, that those appointments would be also be done with a fair representation of female arbitrators. And another aspect that was very important is that the signatories would commit, when they had the power to do so, to collate and make publicly available statistics that when we started, there were very few statistics and it was very difficult to know where we were at the time. And today, 4 years later, we can see already with the ICA report how much information we have been able to put together. In the news today, and it's growing every day, we're very proud of that, is there are 4,355 signatories from all around the world, covering all regions of the world. And most importantly, I would like to think that this has really contributed to the advancement of the number of appointments of female arbitrators from 12.2% average in 2015, when we started with the pledge, to around 21.3% in 2019. What is important to remember is that this initiative is a grassroots initiative. We have no funding, we have no infrastructure, we don't have a formal organization. So the work that is done by the members and the energy that all of our members have and the ideas that all of them have. We just provide around the pledge with the support and a little bit the structure, but everything is done through our members. We have subcommittees now to be able to cover more territory. We have a subcommittee in Latin America, Africa, and India. We will soon launch Asia and the Pacific region and also the Middle East. We have launched this year as well a subcommittee for General Counsel. And this is very important because we need to make sure our users are involved and they have a big say in appointing arbitrators. So the news on that front is that they will be launching very soon a corporate guidelines to explain how corporates can implement the pledge within their organizations, which we think is going to be very useful. We launched 2 years ago the Pledge Award, and I think this is a very good idea because lawyers were all competitive, so we all want to win awards. And that has given a lot of motivation to people to be proactive. And you might know last year was the winner was the LCIA, and it was a recognition of the fact that 43% of the LCIA's appointments in 2019 were female arbitrators, and that number went to 48% in 2019. And the prior year we had Bootfor, the third-party funder, who had earmarked $50 million for funding cases that were led by a female counsel. So we can see there a lot of new and innovative ideas. So, and finally, as Mires was saying, the important thing is there are many organizations there that we all have the same objective. And of course, we try to collaborate and try to put efforts together to get a better result.
Okay, thanks so much. I want to just underscore impressive. ERA Pledge, a grassroots organization, they've realized a 9% increase since inception. So progress and success, the anchors of today's program, are really there and being realized. We're going to pivot. You know, Noyana spoke about implementation within corporate entities for the pledge and missions forward. Let's take a look into the law firms. What are concrete steps? What's happening as law firms look inward? Santiago, we go to you first, please.
Thank you, Rekha. Well, I would like to thank my female partners and female associates who also helped me to make the list of the effective actions that we are dealing at Marvalu with this, with the gender diversity agenda. I would like to comment briefly some of the initiatives, just to share our perspective from a law firm in Argentina dealing with this matter that may help for the discussion. The first thing that I would like to mention is our diversity committee realized some years ago that it would be necessary to create diversity working groups composed by partners, associates, but also by administrative staff, because the inclusion of the gender diversity agenda should also encompass the administrative staff. And we have created the women working group, age diversity group, disability, ethnic, LGBT. And the purpose of these five working groups was to continue analyzing, but especially proposing initiatives and tools to improve inclusion, diversity within the firm. The purpose is equal opportunities for everybody. So what I want to comment is the result of these five working groups. For example, we have launched last year a nursing room helping mothers coming back to work with the idea to contribute to soft landing and work-life balance. It was an initiative very well accepted by our female associates because they and also our female staff because they really used this nursing room for this soft landing with their babies. We also created a project that we call kindergarten adaptation to encourage parents to participate during the first weeks of the year in the adaptation process of the toddlers. That enable parents to take some time off that requires from us, the law firm, flexibility, because otherwise it's not possible to grant this to parents if we don't have the flexibility to do so. So they can adapt their working day to participate in this important educational stage of their young children. Third initiative has to do with the career development of female lawyers with two, I would say, special objectives. Awareness in what we call work allocation and team building. Why? Because it's important for female lawyers when we decide as partners to allocate the an arbitration or to allocate, for example, a project within the firm to take the gender diversity on track, because otherwise that would not help them to continue improving. So team building, yes, when we have to choose who would lead a team, give female lawyers that opportunity, promoting those female lawyers for the leading of those projects. The other thing was to create several events, especially for women, organized by women, and where women only women can speak, and where there can be an interaction with peers, and we have organized several events with different tasks: arbitration, antitrust, compliance, interaction between law firms, between in-house lawyers, and it was an excellent networking opportunity for females lawyers to interact and to find a common path in order to solve these matters. Another initiative that I would like to share is the Economic Violence Against Women project. This is a project aimed at understanding how gender economic violence is addressed in different jurisdictions to prevent and help women fight against it. So we developed this program to help the women to understand which are their rights, which are the resources that they have to fight against economic violence. And we have done many seminars and events with a lot of attendees, not only from Argentina, but from the region. And the issue was how the lack of economic independence should be solved and how can be solved, and try to start working on policy and legislative recommendation. And we are now working on a best practices report, which also be relevant for this matter to be achieved. We have also organized and supported the celebration of the International Women's Day. This was an initiative from the working group, Women Working Group. We placed banners on each of the floors, encouraging people to share thoughts. And it was incredibly interesting, this initiative, because it was a source for future initiatives. Because we found a lot of proposed proposals, which gave rise to open discussion. So that was really very important. Another program launched in 2017, we launched a mentoring program. We called it Empoderar, which means empower. Empower women lawyers to develop their careers, to promote change, and to try to find those tools for them to be promoted. And we really so far achieve improvements because we have improved female lawyers in our pipeline for partnership, which is something that we should work hard, at least at Narval, and we are doing correctly. We did not achieve so far the nomination of many women, but we are on the path. I don't know if I have time to comment just two more, Rekha, but I think we in December 2017, we implemented what we call the Work Efficiency Program. What is it about? It's about the idea to make the life of each lawyer more predictable. This is something that in Argentina, our associates are claiming, just to improve their work-life balance without having a negative impact on the firm. So what we did? Well, we established a single policy. All professionals are expected to be at the office at 9 with the idea of leaving office at 6 if nothing urgent is needed. And we found that results were very positive because we improved the work-life balance. Associates in several surveys that we conducted said that they were really very, very attractive with this initiative. And we found that our recruiting rates and retention rates were really improved, which is something relevant. Another issue that I would like to share, initiative, has to do with the bonus, the performance bonus. We decided that women during maternity leave also deserve this type of bonus, notwithstanding they, of course, because of this maternity leave, they are not working, but this should not be, they should not be punished because of this, and that is something important to comment. And last, I would say we extended leave of absence for fathers. You know, in Argentina, only grants a 2-day paid for fathers, and we concluded that fathers should be given the opportunity to share more time with their babies during these early days. And we extended up to 7 days because we are on the belief that sharing responsibilities allows better chances for a professional career of both parents. So this is some of the initiatives from a law firm perspective. I think that may help to share with you and have an input from a law firm in Argentina.
Santiago, thank you so much. Santiago today spoke to us about access and advocacy, which, remember those items, we'll turn to them shortly. He also spoke to empoderar, empowerment, and predictability as firms look inward. Many of our speakers today wear several hats, and so both Santiago and Noyana look inward as well at their firms to try to figure out implementation. Cognizant of time, we're going to pivot next to looking at academic centers and even specialized international arbitration programs that have burgeoned in recent years. Patricia, talk to us about what initiatives are happening in the academic circles.
Well, there are some initiatives which are focused on increasing gender and other types of diversity. We're focused on gender today, but I think we all are very cognizant that diversity is a much, much broader need and inclusiveness. But I would say focusing more on the arbitration community and and gender from a male-female perspective. I think that the LLMs, as well as some of these certification special courses, like Paris Program, PCA, the Austrian Arbitration Academy, et cetera, they provide opportunities for women to be able to compete on an equal basis with men. Because it can be very difficult when women are entering into job places, competing for the jobs, getting into the job places, to compete on an equal basis for a number of reasons, which we've been discussing today, such as unconscious bias, the mirror image thing, and all of that. But in an academic environment, now is we're up to, you know, a couple of decades where you see in the law environment that about half and sometimes more of all of the students are actually women. And so this is an environment that they have been successfully competing in. And in these programs, they have an opportunity to successfully compete and to interact and have dialogue and build networks with their fellow students, with their faculty. And in many of these programs, they have excellent integration of guest professors and practitioners who come and interact in different ways with the students. So it really provides a place, a safe place, where women can excel and build those kinds of relationships and networks that will help them to identify and open doors to opportunities in their careers. And also exciting, I'd like to point out that in many of these specialized programs, which are really not that old, I think the Stockholm program I started back in 2002, Queen Mary, of course, is about 35 years of age. We have the MIDS program about 10 or 12 years. So they're relatively new, but it's kind of exciting. If you look around, we have Gabriella Kohler-Kaufman, Maxie Scherer, Catherine Rogers, Anne-Marie Witzel, Margaret Moser, Janet Walker. Many of the programs that are well known are run by women, or women have very important roles. So it also provides a mentor, a role model for both men and women about the role that women can play, and that women are in a leading, mentoring, and educating role, which I think is really valuable for both the men and the women as they're getting prepared to enter into this career. So I will leave it at that because time is short and we have many other interesting speakers and perspectives.
Thank you so much, Patricia. So equality, integration, mentorship. We're now going to pivot to talking about the institutions. I note that there have been some questions posited into the chat, specifically asking about the role of international organizations. The specific reference there was made, for example, to ICJ, but in general, organizations, as well as how can law societies and other bar associations help push the agenda. So sort of like-minded in the space with the institutions, I go, Patricia, if you want to weigh in on the SCC, we can go to Sarah then for the HKIAC and end with Mirez on the ICC with regards to institutions.
Well, to be short, let me say Sweden stands out and has for a long time of being, on a worldwide basis, a relatively pro-diversity jurisdiction. And certainly the SEC is an institution that wholeheartedly embraces that and has had for a number of years different programs and activities, including sponsoring a organization and hosting it, SWAN, Swedish Arbitration, or Swedish Women's Arbitration Network, which collaborates a lot with arbitral women. So definitely there's been a taking the pledge very seriously. The appointments to the tribunals have had very, very awareness of having diversity on those panels, as well as inviting speakers for seminars and other activities, and generally supporting a diverse and therefore better functioning community. But I think I'll turn over to Sarah because she's doing us a huge favor by being up in the middle of the night there. So Sarah, and you're working in an environment that maybe has not traditionally been so pro-diversity as we are in Stockholm.
Yeah, thanks, Patricia. So at the HKIC, I want to talk about three initiatives. We signed the pledge back in 2016, and as such, we trace on a weekly basis and we publish on an annual basis all of our statistics around appointments and diversity. So that's all available on our website. With respect to appointments, after signing the pledge, we put in place a policy whereby when we shortlist candidates to our appointments committee, which is the body that makes the appointments in our cases, and we make about 120 appointments every year, so about 2.5 a week. Every shortlist must contain at least the name of at least one qualified female candidate, where possible. That's not always possible because when you layer on conflicts, language requirements, whether or not someone has been appointed many times already, you can quickly, the pool of female candidates can shrink quite quickly. But there is a proactive policy in place, and we've seen some great results. So, for example, in 2016, 6.8% of all of our institutional appointments were of women, and in 2019 that rose to 20.5, and as of today, this year, we're at 23% of appointments of women. And what that also requires is that the institution, you have to find qualified candidates. As an institution, we're very lucky because our vantage point is excellent in that we see the work of many hundreds of different arbitrators and hundreds of counsel. And so we can see who is a quality candidate, who is qualified. And it's very much, I think, part of our role to grow the pool of talented candidates and arbitrators for now and for the next 5 years, the next 10 years, for the sake of our users. One of the other ways in which we do that is that we are very cognizant of the need to showcase female talent in addition to male talent. Every year we organize multiple events like many of the other arbitral institutions. So for example, in 2019, we organized 45 events and 45% of the speakers on our events were women. Six of our events were all women. And so far this year, we've run 34 events, most of which have been webinars, which have a much wider exposure actually than in-person events. And 57% of speakers on those events have been women. We have an active policy whenever we're organizing or co-organizing that our panels must include gender diversity, as well as other types of diversity, but gender diversity is a must. And so for Hong Kong Arbitration Week, that's also a guidance that will apply to all entities that are participating. And then the final initiative I want to talk about is the establishment of WIA, Women in Arbitration, which is a professional networking program and platform for women in mainland China. It is unique. It's the only network of its kind. We established that in February 2018. That was established out of our Shanghai office in China. And that we've run 12 events through that platform. And the membership, depending on how you measure it, we have a WeChat group of 280 members and an email subscription group of 485 members. 62% of women, of speakers in the events put on by WIA have been women. But the one thing I want to raise to everybody's attention is a survey that has been launched by WIA just in the last 2 weeks. And this is a survey that's going to explore the equal representation of women in arbitration in mainland China and analyze the statistics on the appointment of female arbitrators in arbitration in China with the support of over 10 arbitral institutions on the mainland, which individually appoint or administer thousands of cases, largely domestic cases, but also more and more international cases. So it's really an important space of arbitration that we need to be thinking about and measuring. And so we've launched the survey with a view to publishing a report next year, which will touch on many of the issues that we see touched on in the ICA report, but this will be specific to mainland China. One of the angles will also be comparing the difference between mainland China and the international community. So I would say watch this space. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Mirez, the floor is yours. Please tell us about the International Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Rekha. I'm very impressed by the report of Sarah. And I would like also, before speaking about the ICC, I would like also to thank Santiago. I was truly impressed to hear about all the initiatives of your firm, Santiago. You can't imagine how important it is to share such experience. It's an inspiration to other firms. And I will ask you afterwards if you agree to share a report for Arbiter Women newsletter. And this is a shout out, because it is so important for firms to share their experience about initiatives to support female practitioners in their workplace. So don't hesitate to contact Arbiter Women if you have internal programs that you would like to share with peers in order to inspire others. So thank you to both. Now, speaking about the ICC, I can say that having been at the Secretariat of the Court for over 3 decades, I have seen a tremendous change. And I have seen a tremendous change in the arbitration environment in general. So just to give you an idea, when I started collecting statistics, the gender statistics about female nominations at the ICC, in 2010, the percentage of female arbitrators was 7%, 2010, so this is 10 years ago, it's not that far from now. And last year, we reached 21%. So this is a visible progress, although more progress is needed not only at the ICC, but everywhere. But it is just to tell you that in the past, we used to count female arbitrators on the fingers of one hand. So this has changed, and I am very positive about the change in the future. The ICC Court is also a signatory of the ERA Pledge. And you also know that the Court has achieved gender parity in 2018, and this is really a historical moment. The women in managing positions at the Secretariat of the Court now outnumber members. We also insist with the national committees to reflect basically two issues. We insist on, first, that gender diversity within the nomination commissions with the national committees in charge of proposing arbitrators, that such nomination commission reflect generational and gender diversity, as well as various components of the local arbitration community. And second, the court insists on gender diversity when national committees propose arbitrators. So they should therefore make best efforts to achieve and maintain gender parity in their nomination commissions and favor gender diversity in the proposals they make. Regarding conferences, I have no statistics like Sarah, and kudos for having collected such statistics, but we hope in the future to be able to provide them. Women are present on all panels, and it's really something that we insist on. The ICC Court has been extremely proactive regarding gender diversity in the recent years. So there is parity on the panels. There is parity also with the Young Arbitrators Forum's representatives. There is parity on the board, the editorial board of the Bulletin of the Court. And last year, a woman was nominated at the head of the Commission on Arbitration and ADR. This is also historical. Finally, we also have another initiative which is not related specifically to the court, although it comprises staff members from the Secretariat of the Court. It's a staff-driven initiative of ICC called World Business Women, which is intended to promote gender diversity. So initiatives continue, and we continue to be engaged in gender diversity. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mirez. Just a quick snapshot to our delegates. So we have two more topics to go through with you. We will go a bit over the 1:15 mark, if you will allow us, but we will finish before 1:30. And so with that, here we go. Around the world, perspectives and access and advocacy are our two remaining tranches. We'll begin with Latin America. Key local, regional considerations as we deal with diversity gaps and towards progress. Noyana, and then Santiago, please, the floor is yours. Tell us what's happening.
So I will start with the U.S. and then I will let Santiago describe the initiatives in Latin America. And before going there, I would just want to add one more thing to the prior topic. And it's just to say that I'm really proud that in 278 years of Fresh Fields, we appointed last week the first female senior partner in the history of our firm. So we're all very proud. I think it's a huge step forward in showing that really women have to take and are taking leadership positions, which is exactly what we've been fighting for. So very good development there in terms of firms' initiatives. In the Americas, of course, the gender diversity initiatives are still the focus of many institutions, but I think we cannot avoid acknowledging that it has been a shift in the U.S. today, and we are focusing now more on the gaps in Black people and people of color in general. And of course, the Black Lives Matter movement has put the spotlight there, and I think that this has also been compounded by the disparities impact of COVID-19 on those communities of color. And this is something that we have always discussed, even in the context of the pledge. So of course we're focusing on gender diversity, but diversity in general is important. And as Mireille was saying, we just need to tackle small or some aspects of the problems in order to make sure we are being effective, but we cannot forget that there are other disparities out there. And I was reading a report of the American Bar Association that really reveals a disturbing stagnation in advancement of women of color in the profession. This study reports that although there are now 15% of women of color are associates in big law firms, only 4% or below 4% make it to the partnership. So, of course, here we have a combination of two elements of minorities, women and people of color. And if we think about the arbitration field, we don't have that many women arbitrators, even less women of color. So I think this is going to be an area where we will be focusing on the next couple of years in the U.S., in particular, but also around the world. And we have seen already this week top in-house lawyers and global financial institutions like JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs that had launched an initiative similar to kind of a pledge and trying to push law firms to staff their matters with underrepresented attorneys and seek to hire minority lawyers in the firms and in all other legal service providers. So hopefully we start making progress there as well. The second diversity gap in the US at the moment is also LGBT groups. If we think that only last June, the US Supreme Court ruled that the Civil Rights Act protect gay and in general, the LGBT workers from discrimination. In the U.S., there has been a landmark decision that makes it clear that it is unlawful to fire people because they are LGBTQ. And although it seems unbelievable that we need this clarification in 2020, that shows that there is a lot of work to be done there. And of course, if we try to shift that not only to the community in general, but the arbitration community, I'm sure we all agree that these are aspects of diversity that we will also have to address in the coming years. And I will leave with that to Santiago to tell us a little bit more what are the next steps in Latin America.
Thank you, Noyana. And I will, Mireia, thank you for your comment. And of course, I am a strong supporter of this gender diversity issue. And I am, of course, available for anything you may need from a British woman. I am your ambassador in Latin America if you would like to continue moving forward with this exciting matters. In terms of Latin America, I would like to share with everybody an initiative that is called Women Way. Many of you maybe is aware of it. It's a distinguished group of women lawyers with a lot of experience in arbitration, with focus in LATAM, but of course they also are working for arbitrations, both as counsels and arbitrator all over the world. And this group of women started this organization with the aim of promoting the participation of women in arbitration, to treat and the fundamental value that any development model must achieve equality and gender equality is and shall be on the agenda. There are many seminars and events organized by them. I strongly recommend you to follow also this organization, who is a young organization, I would say, but with a lot of support, and we from Arbal are supporting a lot of this initiative. The second comment from Latin America, I learned there was something from the IBA, and I read a very interesting paper from the Council of the Latin American Forum. It's a research project called The Perception of Legal Firms with Regards Diversity and Inclusion. It's an interesting paper because it deals with the law firms in Latin America, especially, and with a lot of hard data and surveys. There is a source for you if you are interested in analyzing how the gender agenda is dealing with in Latin America and the law firm. It's a good tool for you to understand the current situation. The conclusion of this research is the majority of the countries promotes the equal treatment and diversity as a general guideline, which is something that we celebrate, of course. However, there is still, as we have been mentioning everybody in this panel, a lack of awareness among the population, and especially lack of specific public measures. What I think is that the enforcement, the specific enforcement of these general guidelines is not proper, is not accurate, and there is a lot of to do on this stuff. The survey that this IBA project conducted also shows that there is a perception that discrimination is not a priority matter within the law firms. What is interesting is this paper describes which are the strategies that the law firm should follow in order to tackle this matter. Mm? They propose events for discussions, promoting awareness, something we have been saying along this panel. And something which is, for me, very important, the flexible working programs. This is something in the law firm we should work a lot to continue strengthening how to combine life and work in a better way, because I am absolutely in favor of this. The absence of a flexible working schedule makes difficult to reconcile professional and family life, and prevents women from progressing, because it is unacceptable for a woman who would like to also deal with her family and kids, if she doesn't find a flexible working arrangement within the law firm. So I strongly recommend also this project called Perception of Legal Firms with Regards to Diversity and Inclusion from the IBA. This is, Reka, what I found in Latin America of almost interesting for sharing with our colleagues.
Thanks so much, Noyana and Santiago. Just a note to the delegates, to the degree you're looking for any of the referenced items that the speakers have offered, they are within the chat function via hyperlink. Do look there. So there's a lot that's been done, as we've heard from Noyana and Santiago. There's a lot to do. These flexible work programs become even more relevant in pandemic as personal and professional collide in real time. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's move from the Americas to Europe. I'm going to invite Patricia to weigh in, and then Mirez, not only looking at Europe, but also looking at the MENA region. Patricia, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, in Europe, I would say this probably, after listening to Santiago, boy, I wish we could clone him and send him around the world. I think in Europe, we like to think of ourselves as being relatively at the top of the class in these, in the situation and in the initiatives going on. But I've really been impressed, as Mirez pointed out, with the things that are being done in Latin America. So I think we should be all inspired by them. But in Europe, we do have some general trends which are positive, and that is, for one thing, in the social context, that in the European countries, most of the countries do have systems in place which are increasingly giving and encouraging parental time in connection with the birth or adoption of a child to a man. So, for example, in Sweden, we have 18 months of parental leave, and it was introduced several years ago that 3 of those months only the father of the child may take. And it's being discussed if it should be increased to 6 of those months. And that has a very positive effect. And studies have shown that when men are encouraged to stay home with the children, not only do they have an opportunity to develop a better relationship with the child and the child with them, but it then evens the playing field so that at the point of hiring, firms are not saying, she may be having 1, 2, 3 kids, so we can expect she's going to be gone 1, 2, 3 times 18 months. Then it puts them in the even playing ground, because so could the male hire be gone. So I think that's good. It's also notable in Europe that we have, in most countries, very affordable, subsidized, good quality public childcare for kids at the young age and then after school programs. So these types of social benefits really help. And many of the firms try to augment them or to make them even more favorable through their firm processes. So I think supporting the lifestyle choices of the workers is important. And I think we need to remember, I mean, we all know it, but I think we can't remember it enough, and that is diversity is good business. And diversity is particularly good business when you're in the business of human resources. Because in the law business, what we're basically selling is the quality of the legal advice that can be, and service that can be given by the people that are hired. So if the firm is not hiring the best talent, and if the firm is not giving training and development potential to those that they hire, and if the firm is not retaining and promoting its best talent, then that's a really poor business model. And increasingly we're seeing that firms are starting to realize that. It's been a lot of awareness campaigns. And one of the things which is also kind of an exciting development, that's not just in Europe, we're seeing it in the Americas as well, and Sarah can tell us about Asia, I'm not sure, but that is there are now regular different organizations offering prizes for the firm with the greatest diversity or the most successful or the most impressive diversity initiative or statistics and such. So you see a lot of the firms now, in order to make themselves competitive, part in getting the best talent, but also in impressing clients, are putting into place not just window dressing, but really meaningful programs to help attract, train, and retrain diverse, high-quality colleagues in the firm. And I think that's something that we also see coming increasingly from the client. And we are now, you know, it used to be, I'm pretty old, so I can say it used to be that oftentimes that women started to feel that being in the law firm environment just was not something that they were willing to trade off in the life balance. And so many of them would go into corporate counsel. And it used to be that corporate counsel was kind of perceived as a second road to travel. Not any longer. The rise of corporate counsel and their role has increased tremendously in the past decade, particularly in Europe. Europe lagged behind the U.S. in corporate counsel. And today we're seeing that corporate counsel are doing exciting work. They're well paid. They're in positions of great influence. And many of the corporate counsels at the top leadership level are now women. And many of the corporate clients now are demanding that even at the beauty contest level of selecting firms, they want to see teams that are diverse. They want to ensure that the team is going to be able to have a consistency so that it's not going to be such that women on the team need to bail out because of their different needs. But the team is put together and properly staffed so there can be a consistent top talent all the way through. And the firms themselves, the companies, the clients themselves have these diversity goals that they want to achieve through how they're procuring their legal services. So diversity is good business. And trust me, as somebody who works with students, and the students I've worked with, and not just in the Stockholm community, those firms which tend to have a very male, macho, not genuinely inclusive culture, the top talent coming out of the school know who they are, and they get reputations that you don't want to go there. So it's good business.
Thanks so much, Patricia. Mirez, please.
I would like to pick up on one point regarding the pandemic. I think that for every misfortune, there are positive things that may arise. And the positive aspect of the pandemic is to have proven to the world that women can continue to be efficient while working remotely. Minds are now ready. Like, clients now know that they can contact their lawyers remotely, that they can meet with them, that people can continue working, and that the fact of working remotely does not prevent women from continuing to be efficient and hopefully from retaining women, and all the parental mentorship programs are so important. So I think this is very important to remember. Women can continue working. Now, regarding the MENA region, I have personally observed a significant change between 2000 and 2010. And it's now even more, it has progressed even more, although the road is still long. And let me tell you about it. So when I was in charge of promoting ICC arbitration in the MENA region between 2000 and 2005, there were extremely few women in the room at any given event, and women were silent. Most of the participants had headphones to hear the translation from English into Arabic. And then in 2010, I was invited to speak, and I started seeing a clear change. Many women were not only present in the room, but also participated actively in conferences and workshops. And in general, new generations of men and women spoke English and needed no headphones. They participated quite actively. And in the recent years, we also started seeing more and more women invited to speak on panels. So I was happy to see this positive change during this decade. Today in the MENA region, a significant number of women work, whether they are expats or women from the region. Many in-house counsel are women. The registrar and chief executive of the Abu Dhabi Global Market Courts, ADGM, is a woman, and so is the court registrar at the Dubai International Financial Center, the DIFC. That being said, I doubt that the culture and the traditions allow women to work without prior approval of their family, usually given by their fathers or their husbands. So I doubt that women are free to choose today, but hopefully things are changing and will continue to change. However, considering the progress observed in the region in the recent years, I really hope that this progress will, we will see this progress very quickly, because there are more and more involved people in organization wishing to show that they are modern, that they understand the issue, and that they are inviting more women. Talents are equally strong for both genders, so we need to be realistic about this. And talents are not a privilege of one gender. So using the talents of a nation is a business plan and a positive aspect of local economies. There are also some efforts undertaken in Saudi Arabia, but the situation is different from the Emirates, and many efforts remain to be done in this region. So just to give you an idea about the number of women arbitrators from the MENA region, in 2018, out of the 1,484 arbitrators appointed or confirmed by the ICC court, 273 were women, which represented only 18.4%. And from the 273 women, 12 were from the MENA region, which represented 4% of the women nominated. So I hope that this will increase and we will see more change in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Merez. Sarah, next to you, Outlook on Asia.
Thanks, Rekha. I have to admit, I really struggled with this question because Asia is enormous and the jurisdictions are really varied. So you have some of the least developed jurisdictions to some of the most sophisticated jurisdictions in Asia, like Hong Kong, Singapore. So it's really diverse. But I'll give some observations that I can. I think that we do see pipeline issues, and I know that we as an institution see that on the front line. For example, when we're looking to the Hong Kong bar and to the Hong Kong law firms that are specializing in arbitration, to give you some figures, in 2017, the Hong Kong bar, there were 1,300 barristers, just over 400 of them were women, so about 30%. But of the senior counsel, which is the equivalent to a Queen's Counsel in England, the number of women is 12%. So there's a real drop-off at some point in the woman's career, and I think as we see around the world, that really starts to happen quite acutely when families start to have children, and then it's really the woman who bears most of the burden and joy of raising the child. And then with respect to law firms, when we did an informal survey at HKIC last year of the law firms with very active arbitration departments, and that we identified approximately 18. And of the most active partners of those firms, there were 49 partners, and 9 of those partners were women. So that's 18%. So there, when you're an institution, you're very often looking at appointing at the partner or the SC level, depending on the case, of course. So there are major pipeline issues, and I think that replicates in other of the major jurisdictions in Asia, like Singapore, Korea, mainland China, Japan, and then, you know, going through the other jurisdictions, I think that's also exacerbated. With respect to retention of women in careers, again, we're looking at child care and flexible working arrangements. Those things are so intertwined. The thing about some of the Asian jurisdictions is that you have affordable live-in help, and that is a real phenomenon that changes families' lives and makes it possible for women to go back to work earlier and have the support they need to do that. At the same time, I think it's true to say that there is a very strong culture in terms of the emphasis is on the woman to be at home, to stay at home, to take care of children. And that is not, I don't think it's anywhere near as close to being culturally a norm for a man to do that, to take on that role. I think that there's still a lot of change to be made there, because that does make things much easier for women in terms of going back to work. So I think, and that is reflected in the type of parental leave arrangements that you see in the legislation in many Asian jurisdictions. In Hong Kong, 14 weeks for women and 5 days for men. Having said that, you do have some of the international firms and, for example, the international investment banks who operate in a very different way and have equal parental leave. So, but by and large, it's not like that. So those would be my observations, just a couple of observations to give you a sense.
Well, and Sarah brings up a really good point. You know, in covering the Americas and Asia, we asked Noyana, Santiago, and Sarah to really straddle a diversity of access points. This is true in general of the world, but our focus was really to talk also positively, not only shining a light on what more can be done, but acknowledging, as many of us have reaffirmed what Santiago has said, there's already been a lot done, even though there's always more to do. Thoughtful of time, what I wanted to do now is to invite our speakers to offer one mantra that they live by when it comes to creating change, popcorn style, in one sentence. And so, Sarah, as you just had the mic, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, so I have two. The first one is, the harder you work, the luckier you get. So I think that it's not all about luck, but, you know, it's about working, it's about carrying on. And the second is, never, 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 never give up.
Okay. Noyana, your mantra.
Quite similar. Actually, I would say focus your energy on action and positive thinking. Don't waste your energy concentrating on what might be more difficult for you or what might be unfair or what could have gone better. Just move forward.
Okay. Merez, please.
This is something I say all over, basically, the place. As Sarah said, never give up, but I would say perseverance always pays in anything. Be firm without being arrogant. This is important.
Okay, Patricia, the floor is yours.
The only time I ever say no is when I'm asked if I've had enough.
There it is. Santiago, please.
Yes, I chose the following. Gender diversity is a must. Let's continue working to achieve it, but shortly.
Yeah.
Well, delegates, there you have it. I think these are the best last words. On behalf of NIAC and the ABA Section of Dispute Resolution, it has been a pleasure to sit down with you today. I thank sincerely our erudite cohort of speakers who put their actions where their words are to effectuate change. We also together thank all of you, the delegates, for tuning in. Please do take a look at the checklists, acknowledging that the ICA report is long. They will guide you on what you can do to keep moving the needle forward. With that, we're going to sign off here. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon.